gonna take a sentimental journey. Gonna tune to 660. Never thought my heart could be so yearning. Wanna hear good radio. KFAR.
Good morning, friends, and welcome to KFAR Radio's Meet a Pioneer. Today is January 18th, 1985. I'm Gail Malloy. Each Friday morning at 9 o'clock, we meet a pioneer. We'll spend the next hour with Ingeborg Wilson. She's best known as an author and as an original member of the Board of Trustees for Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank. This morning's presentation is sponsored by Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank, Interior Signs, Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, Larson's Jewelers, Sophie Station, Two Rivers Lodge, Denali Chiropractic, and the Riverboat Discovery. Rosenthal's violin and Doris Stevenson on the piano, Alaska Flag Song. Good morning, Inge Wilson.
Good morning, Gail.
Nice to have you in the studio today.
Well, thank you for asking me.
I mentioned earlier, before our program started, within the last hour, to some of to our listeners that you are my youngest guest. You're just a kid.
I'm just a kid. I think there are some pioneers who would have lots different stories than mine, because mine isn't really a story of hardship. You know, it's just a story of adjustment.
Uh-huh. Well, it's you became a member of the Pioneers of Alaska in 83?
That's right.
Which qualified you as a 30-year resident, or you qualified...
That's right.
Uh-huh. Well, we're going to tell your story in a different way than we have with anybody else. We're going to kind of start at the middle and come to the end and then go back to the beginning.
All right.
And kind of set the stage. I mentioned to our listeners earlier that talking to you and hearing some of the stories you're going to tell is a rare opportunity. I have certainly never heard some of the stories from the first-hand point of view like we'll hear from you. Now, you were born January 19th, and I promised I wouldn't tell the year, but of course after we talked to you in the hour, some of our quick-minded listeners are going to figure it out. But January 19th is tomorrow, and so I'd like to say happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and you were born in Berlin.
Right. Berlin, Germany.
Now, just give us a little background on your family and your history.
Well, my dad worked for the railroad over there. He was a freight station manager, and the railroad was civil service in Germany. There were just two of us in the family, my brother and I, and he did not come back from World War II in Russia. He was never declared dead. He was just a person missing in action.
Now, he was a young...
He was a young fellow, and I just wanted to say again, like I said to you yesterday, he was not in the Nazi army. He was in the German army. You guys had President Roosevelt, who was a Democrat, so you didn't have a Democrat army. You had the U.S. army, and we had a German army. The Nazis were something different.
That's one thing we're going to talk about a little bit. I learned so much from talking to you yesterday that amazed me. But the Nazis, before we get into, like you say, was simply a political party
right. In
Germany that took power. And so at the time that your brother was fighting, he was just a few years older than you.
Yes.
He was fighting for the
Germans.
Germans, period.
Right.
Okay. So now you were, what, about a teenager probably during the years of the war?
During the years of the war, yes, I was a teenager. Well, I'm 50 plus, and you can put as many pluses on as you like.
Okay. All right. Well, we were talking yesterday about you were living at home, of course, with your folks. Your brother was gone fighting the war, and Berlin, of course, was bombed. Now, that's history we know about. Tell us what it was like, the circumstances of war in wartime Berlin.
Well, it was very heavily bombed, and we had, of course, any new housing that was built, and in a large city like that, Berlin had 4 million people. We lived mostly in apartments, and the new apartment buildings that were built, and they were all built out of brick. Wooden buildings over there is just something you don't have, maybe for a weekend cottage. But they all were built with air raid shelters, because as far back as, well, I could say as far back as the time Hitler took power, which was January the 30th of 1933, he knew he was going to take us into war. And so they prepared for it.
Okay, we're going to come back to that in just a little bit, but we're going to proceed with the rest of your life, so we'll have a point of view when we go back to that part of history. Now, where the story kind of picks up, where you start to get involved in your passage to America, is as a young woman when you met your husband-to-be for the first time.
Right.
Tell us that story.
Well, we met right after the war, actually, in 1945, and when the Americans occupied that section of town in Berlin that I was in, Berlin was divided into four sectors. Germany was divided into four zones. Luckily, I was in the American sector of Berlin. And since we had to, in high school, since English and French were mandatory languages for us, my English was pretty good, and I was able to find employment. There was very little employment in the German industry. In fact, the German industry was non-existent. And so, well, sure enough, there was somebody there waiting for me. There was Ed.
Now, you were a translator.
I was an interpreter, yeah.
An interpreter,
uh-huh,
okay.
Right. Not right away. I started as a secretary there.
Uh-huh.
And then, well, we knew each other for a year, and then he came back to the States and stayed.
Now, he was in the Army?
He was in the Army, and he was in charge of the motor pool and the supplies. And so I had to go to him for supplies when I needed things for typing and taking dictation and all those things. And he was a very, very nice person. There were some Americans who felt superior to us because they had just won the war. And Ed never made anybody feel that way, whether it was a German woman or a German man. To him, we were just other people.
Uh-huh.
And
you two fell in love.
And we fell in love.
Was that okay? I mean, was it okay for Germans and Americans to...
Well, it was okay for us to fall in love, but they had a ban on Americans marrying German girls, and they didn't lift that until the 1st of January of 1947, at which time he had just left Germany.
No. And he left right before the ban was lifted?
Yes, he did. And all my friends, of course, said, uh-oh, he just made it out. But he did come back, and we were married for 33 years.
Now, there's a little bit that comes in between that. Now, after he left, you made a promise to each other that you were going to
stay? We were going to, wait for each other or something like that.
Now, what were you waiting for?
Well, he wanted to get back to the States. For one thing, he hadn't seen his parents for a long time, and they kept writing, oh, come home, come home. And And another thing was, of course, if he thought about getting married, he also had to thought about an occupation or going to college or something. You know, mm-hmm. you have a responsibility, more responsibility when you get married than when you're single. And so he came over here. Well, he was like so many young men are after a war. They are restless. And I guess he was restless, too. And it took him 3 years to come back, but I was still there.
Now, you waited and wrote for 2 years, and
yes.
then you gave up, right?
I gave up for a brief period because he didn't write. And I'm a born letter writer. I love to write, and I love to write letters, and I write long letters, and everybody tells me interesting letters. I hope they are. And I wrote him long love letters, and first I got some too, and I knew he didn't like to write that much, but then he didn't write for a little bit over a year, and I thought, this is it, brother. And then I stopped too.
And you started dating.
And then I started dating again. Right, I hadn't dated for 2 years, and so as soon as I started dating, I guess he must have known ESP over there, or over here, rather. And then all of a sudden he wrote and said he was coming back to get married. And then I said, I don't know if I still want to marry you. Because I said, it's been almost 3 years and I have changed and maybe you have changed. But anyway, we did get married. And first I came to Carolina, then to Ohio. And then in 1953, we came to Alaska.
Now, you grew up in Berlin. What sort of city is Berlin?
Oh, Berlin is beautiful. It was beautiful then. Of course, now it's divided. It wasn't divided when I grew up in it. There were 4 million people were living in Berlin. And Berlin in size is larger than New York City.
Uh-huh.
It's a very green city. It has lots of parks. All the streets are tree-lined. It used to be a very clean city, and they're trying to have it that way again.
So here you are, a young woman, married an American sailor. You sailed across by yourself, across the ocean,
right.
to America. What was that like? What were you thinking then?
Well, he wanted me to come because I had to wait for the paperwork to come through. And you don't come over as an immigrant if you marry an American. You come over as a resident. So, but there's still lots of paperwork. There's bureaucracy in America as well as in Germany. And so he wanted me to come and fly, and I had never flown, and I would have liked to have flown, but I didn't want to make a change from Germany to America in one day or within the same day. And
yeah.
I knew I was going into a different culture, and I just wanted a little more time. So I came on a boat, and the first boat I could get out was a freighter. And we were on the water for 13 days. It was my vacation. There was nothing to do. We just lay down on deck chairs, and we were dressed warmly because it was cold in May. But we all came, when we landed in New York, we all had a nice tan.
Gee, and that's 1950.
That was 1950, that's right.
And your husband met you there.
Yes.
And kind of.
Kind of.
Now, he was from North Carolina. New York City was just a mystery to him.
Oh,
to you.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, then you went to North Carolina, and what sort of life did you have there?
Well, my in-laws, his parents had an apple orchard, and it's beautiful country, and they had a lovely house, but it was very, very different. Really, I felt like stepping back in time a little bit. I mean, coming from the big city, going to this small village in the mountains of North Carolina, it's lovely for a visit, but for me, it wasn't to stay.
Well, that was hard. Did you ever at any time think, I want to go home?
Not really. I kind of make myself promises or vows, as you might call them. I told myself when I left Germany that since I didn't know how we were going to live, what the situation would be, that I would never say, oh, I want to go home. Oh, Ed, I want to go home. No, I always waited until he said, hey, isn't it time for you to go home and visit your mother?
Gee whiz. We'll be back in just a moment after we acknowledge some of our sponsors, Denali Chiropractic, Two Rivers Lodge, and the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop. Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop. Sam and Jane McConkie believe beautiful things are timeless, and everything you find at the Forget-Me-Not Shop is beautiful. Fine linens, silver, crystal, decorator items for your home or office, and that little something for special friends. Forget-me-not adds a feeling of luxury to even the most practical items. So, for beautiful things for years to come, for your friends, your home, or for yourself, remember the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, open 10 to 6, 6 days a week in Northgate Square.
Alaskans have always been famous for their hospitality, the same wonderful hospitality you still find at the Two Rivers Lodge, where Don and Stasha Troutman offer the best menu and interior, a comfortable, quiet atmosphere, and that famous Alaskan welcome to the people who are today's history makers. If you've been meaning to try one of the most talked-about dining experiences in the Alaskan interior, don't wait any longer. Go out tonight to the Two Rivers Lodge, 16 Mile Chena Hot Springs Road.
Alaska's pioneering spirit will never die. It lives on in second and third generation Alaskans like Dr. Carol Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic.
Sponsoring Meet a Pioneer gives Carol an opportunity to show her pride in being an Alaskan and in being a member of the world's largest drugless healing profession. Becoming a chiropractor meant years of demanding study, a period of internship, and then meeting tough licensing standards. She's happy to talk about chiropractic with anyone interested in learning more about it. Just call 479-0485 or stop by and see Carol at 3525 College Road.
Thank you, Dr. Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic. And now back to our program, Meet a Pioneer.
This is Gail Malloy, and we're talking with Ingeborg Wilson, more personally known as Inge. Okay, well, let's see. You went from North Carolina and then over to Dayton, was it?
Dayton, Ohio, right.
For a while. What did your husband do?
He worked for a bus company there for a while. And then he had a cousin up here who kept writing, saying how beautiful Alaska was, and you just ought to come up. So we did.
I mean, just like that.
Almost.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Ed came up one summer by himself because by that time we had a baby.
Oh.
And so he came up by himself, and then when he came back, he wanted to go the next summer again, which then was 53. And I wasn't really all that keen on coming to Alaska. And then I said to myself, oh, he said, well, just for the summer. And I said, he said, for 6 months. And I said, well, you can live any place for a summer. I mean, no matter how beautiful or bad it is, you can always adjust for 6 months. So we came up, and the 6 months stretched into, well, it will be 32 years in May.
Well, tell me, what was your impressions of Fairbanks when you got here, the place that you...
Awful. A city of 4 million, and I arrived here, and it was 9,000 people in Fairbanks, and very few paved streets. Of course, the airport was much smaller. The terminal was a wooden building. And as he drove us into town, and he was already very proud of Fairbanks, I thought, oh my, this dust, and look at those houses. And then housing, there was a great housing shortage, and he was just lucky to get a trailer for us, and his cousin had a little piece of land, and we parked it on the land there. And for the first time in my life, this big city girl had to use an outhouse and a pump in the yard to get her water. But for summer, you know, you can do anything.
A summer, yeah. Well, why didn't you go out again? What happened? It made you
sad. Well, Ed was working in construction up here, and he was just so fortunate he could work all winter that first winter. So I said, well, we have a little boy. We better get into another place. And so we lived in an apartment first, and then we rented a house. And the following year, we bought a house 1 week before our daughter was born. And the day she was born, we moved into the house.
And where was that house?
That was on 3rd Avenue, 1009 3rd Avenue.
Is it still there?
It's still there. Uh-huh. It's a very old house. It's a pioneer, more of a pioneer than I am. It was built in 1905, the first part of it, uh-huh. And then people added on to it.
I want you to tell the story about your little boy who had decided he wanted a sister for Christmas.
Oh, yeah. He kept saying he wanted a baby sister, and then at Christmas time, I decided, well, I'll give him a doll. What's wrong with a boy playing with a doll? So I put it under the tree, and he ran out. We had Christmas on Christmas Eve, as was the German custom. And so he ran out and picked up this doll, and he said, a baby. And when he felt it, of course he felt it was the baby, he threw it across the room, and he said, this is no baby. This is just a dolly. I want a baby sister. And every night he prayed, and he started out in German saying, lieber Gott, dear God, I want a baby sister. I have been a good boy. And then he got a baby sister 9 months later.
Somebody heard that prayer. Goodness. Well, during all this time, did you start making plans, or when was it you first thought you might go back to Berlin and see Mom? And
well, there were two children now, and at that time, travel to Berlin from here was a long ways off. You didn't have the polar flights. So I didn't say anything, as I mentioned before. And then my mother had gallbladder surgery, and my husband said, why don't you go and see her? And I said, with those two little kids, I said, we'll drive her crazy. And I called the doctor in Berlin and asked him if there really was a need for me to come, a health need. And he said no. And he tried very hard to speak English, and it was he couldn't. And then the following summer, I went with the children. We had to go from here to Seattle, from Seattle to New York, from New York to, where did we stop? In Iceland, I think, and then on to Brussels, Frankfurt, and Berlin.
Now, that was familiar territory to you, but it was not to your little kids. What was the observation of one of your little boys?
That was later on, the one probably that I told you before, when we talked a little bit. Brian was there with me when he was six, and he said, Mommy, he said, why are there so many people on these streets? What are they all doing? I said, they're doing the same thing you and I are doing. They're just walking down the street. They're going to the store, to the post office, shopping. They're going to work, whatever, Brian, just maybe for a stroll. Oh, he had grown up in Alaska, and there just aren't that many people on the street in Fairbanks, but in the city of so many, there are. And to him, it was, we liked Berlin, but it was too many people.
Oh, overwhelming. Well, Fairbanks was different then, of course, not nearly the size it is now. And places that we consider in town now were on the outskirts. What friends did you have? What did you do on a daily basis besides
taking
the
care
home?
Of children? First...
You belong to clubs or
no,
anything like that?
No, not very much. I'm really not a club person. For the first friends we made really were some people my husband knew from his home state. And then gradually you meet other people. And then I went to work. I worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office. We were a territory. We didn't have district attorneys. We had U.S. attorneys. And then I worked at the Alaska Insurance Agency for a couple of years. And I have a friend dating back to those days. Usually I don't... When I make a friend, I usually have them for the rest of my life. I wouldn't say I have gobs and gobs of friends, but the ones I have, they are friends forever.
Uh-huh. Was there anything that you noticed in particular? Were you a novelty at all, being a German woman with a accent, probably then heavier than now, and anything
no,
like that?
No, not really. No, people always, I guess people always consider me German. I'm German-born. Sometimes I worked at the state employment office, and sometimes somebody would ask, where are you from? Where's that accent from? And truly, people who have an accent, they really don't think they have that much of an accent, and they really don't like to be told they have one.
Oh, no, Inga, you have no accent.
So I would tell them, I said, well, I'm. What nationality are you? And I would say, I'm an American just like you. And I am. I am a U.S. citizen. I'm German-born, and I'm proud of both. And I just told Gail before the program that it's all your attitude. You can, when you come to another country to live, and America is not a hard country to adapt to, it becomes what you make it. Excuse me. You can adapt to it and become one of the others, and you have the added advantage of knowing two cultures, or you can be a little enemy of it in a way, and just put everything down and say, well, at home everything is better. Well, it's not. There are certain things that are better, that are nicer, that you've been more used to, but there are certain things that are nicer here and better here, and you get used to it. So, I mean, it's all what you make it.
When did you become a citizen?
In 1954, exactly 2 weeks after my second child was born, right here in Fairbanks. And Judge Forbes, who was the president, the first president of the Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank, was a federal judge then, and he had just come to Alaska, like maybe in August or September of that year. And one of his first official acts was to the swearing-in ceremony for new U.S. citizens, and I was one of those.
What did it involve? And
well, of course, they gave you a little talk. First of all, of course, I spoke English when I came, so that was no problem. But they recommended that you take a little course in American history. And so I did, in the evenings, once a week. One teacher, and I'm sorry I forgot her name, one teacher here who taught in the public schools was kind enough to give us lessons about American history. And by the time I had to take a test, not from her, but from the immigration officer, I knew more about American history than my husband did. And so then at the swearing-in ceremony, we all had to stand up, and they talked a little bit about America to us again, and they were telling us that they were welcoming us with open arms. And then we had to give the oath of allegiance, and then we had to sign our citizenship papers, and they all congratulated us, and that was it. Nowadays, I understand that it's either the pioneer women or the daughters of the American Revolution or one of these patriotic societies. They have a little coffee for them and serve refreshments, but in 1954 they didn't.
When did you start writing?
I started writing in Germany. I was working for a Swiss newspaper man who needed somebody who spoke good English, because at that time everybody was attached to the military, and as a Swiss he was attached to the British. So he didn't speak English, so he needed somebody. And he said he also wanted somebody who could write. And I said, well, I can write. I've never written for publication, but I certainly could give it a try. When you're young, you always think you can do it. And so what he did, and my professor up here really criticized that when I told him many years later, he took my articles, edited them a little bit, not much, and then sent them down to Switzerland to his paper under him. They were published under his name.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Why?
Well, because he got paid for it, and I was just on a straight salary. But I didn't really mind, because it was my apprenticeship. Really?
You were just happy to...
I was just happy to do it, you know, and see it published, even if his name was on it. Of course, later on, then I wouldn't have liked that. And then my first, after I quit the job with him, well, it was because he was transferred to Bonn. The German government then was concentrated in Bonn, and so many correspondents moved there. And I always said I would never live any place but Berlin. And so I stayed on in Berlin at the time. And then I started writing. I worked for the U.S. State Department as an interpreter and administrative assistant. And then I began writing on my own. I thought, well, those articles were published. Why can't I publish them under my own name? And I did.
And what was that name?
Ingeborg Beify. B-E-I-F. Why? That's a very unusual German name, and it used to be spelled differently, B-E-Y, and the B-E-Ys comes from Turkey, and they are Turkish noblemen. So I always tell my children, you come from Turkish nobility, and we have a great laugh about it.
Now, you have had, several hundred articles published.
Right.
This country, Germany, and Canada, Switzerland, and Austria.
Right.
What sort of articles, and how so many countries?
Well, a lot of them are, most of them in the United States are profile stories. Just what you're doing with me now, I would interview somebody and write it instead of airing it, you know. And then sending things to, like, Germany, it would be more things about Alaska. But then, of course, the profile stories have a lot of Alaskan flavor also, because it's people living in Alaska, and what do they different in Alaska from what they would be doing, like, in Ohio or Oregon or North Carolina, you know. And Canada, because I interviewed a couple of Canadians who had went to their hometowns, and
well, this book that I'm thrilled and honored that you autographed for me, Alaskans I Have Met by Ingeborg Wilson. I read a couple of the stories last night. It's wonderful. You've had 9 novels published?
Yes. They were all published in the German language, but not in Germany. excuse me. One was published in Germany. One was published in Luxembourg. And the others were published in Omaha, Nebraska, by a German language publisher.
Now, are these nonfiction novels or fiction?
Fiction, just...
Is that right?
Regular fiction, right. Just stories. One was about a nurse in Alaska. I have a good friend who was a bush nurse. And so there's an article in that little book about bush nurses, too. And so I had, a background there. And
What was her name?
Margaret Gray. But, no, she's not in the story.
Uh-huh.
But her name is Margaret Gray.
Uh-huh.
And worked in the bush as a nurse, and so she would tell me a lot about that, and so it was enough that I could spin a yarn over.
Uh-huh. Well, gosh, there is so much to talk about. We're going to do the best we can in this hour that we have, but let's get to the part of the story where you got involved with Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank.
Oh,
now,
my.
Here you are. You're not a banker by or any that sort of thing, any training on it? How did that happen to come about?
Well, the people who are on boards of banks or in any other boards of corporations are not necessarily people who work in that occupation. Well, and as a matter of fact, they are just something else always, because on our banking board, the only person who is the banker is our president and chairman of the board, Ken Thompson. And it was an idea that popped up first in the head of Julian C. Rice, a well-known Fairbanks attorney, and he talked with friends about it, and then Anchorage friends, and more people, and it just spread. And then he thought it was a good idea to have a mutual savings bank in this town. And so in 1963 is when Julian started with it. In 1964, debentures were offered publicly, and we bought a debenture. At that time, you could only buy one for $3,000 per person. And we bought one, and since my husband worked at Clear Air Force Station 80 miles away, we thought it was a better idea my name be on the debenture because I could go to meetings. We wanted to know what happened.
So if you bought a debenture, you automatically had a say. You were involved. Anybody who did.
Well, you had a say as a corporator.
Okay.
You know, just like people who buy stock. They are stockholders, and they go to meetings, and they vote.
Okay.
And our corporators are something similar. Not really stockholders.
So you bought this simply as an investment.
We bought it as an investment.
And you wanted to support a new business.
And we wanted to support a new hometown bank. And I went to the first meeting, and lo and behold, I was elected to the board. I guess they felt they needed a woman on the board. And naturally, when we had our first meeting as a board, 2 days after the general meeting, Julian Rice said, Mrs. Wilson, do you by any chance take shorthand? I must have looked like the secretary. And I said, yes. And he said, okay, you'll be our secretary. And I said, my goodness, I've never done anything like this. And he said, no big problem. He said, we'll all help you. And they did. And I've been with them ever since, and it's been a wonderful relationship.
We'll be back in just a moment with Inge Wilson on Meet a Pioneer.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by Interior Signs, long established as one of the interior's most professional, most dependable year-round sign makers. They're licensed, insured, and always ready to serve Fairbanks with signs of every kind. Signs for business, contracting, or creative design. So for signs that stand the test of time, call Interior Signs at 479-3859. That's 479-3859. Interior Signs at 2405 South Cushman.
When Roy Larson started Larson's Jewelers on that day back in 1946, he had big dreams of what he'd like his business to become. the years, some of those dreams changed and others came true. Today, Larson's is still a family-owned business and one of the finest and most complete jewelry stores in the interior. Almost 40 years of skill and experience go into everything they do. Like Fairbanks, they've grown, but they're still your friend and neighbor. Larson's, fine jeweler since 1946 at 405 Noble.
Is waiting for you.
20 years ago, Mount McKinley Bank was founded by a group of forward-looking individuals who saw a need in the community. The new bank offered low-interest loans to encourage new home building in the Fairbanks area. It was an immediate success. Today, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is still located at 530 4th Avenue in the same building where founder Julian Rice and first president Judge Vernon Forbes served on the first board of trustees. The bank has seen a lot of history, and their solid background of investment and involvement in the community has earned Mount McKinley their own place in Fairbanks history. Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is proud to sponsor Meet a Pioneer. At Mount McKinley, they're looking forward to a future as proud as their past.
We're back with Ingeborg Wilson on Meet a Pioneer. Well, so you're all of a sudden the secretary treasurer on the board of trustees of a bank.
No, just secretary.
Oh, we secretary.
Treasurer was separate. That was Dan Rammers.
Oh, okay. By the way, what other original members are still on this board?
Besides myself, there are only two original members on the board, and that's Dan Rammers, who is the owner of Tesco Lighting Center, and Leslie Rogers, who is an architect and engineer with LRB.
Huh, so they all got involved in the same way. They had
right.
put some money in it, and they were asked to participate.
Right.
Now, there was one of the board members passed away just recently.
Yeah.
Ted Lowell.
Ted Lowell died last year, and he was a real pioneer. He came up here. He got married in 1925 and came to Alaska in 1926. And I don't know what all areas he's lived in, but he's lived in many different areas. I think he lived in McGrath at one time. He was a trapper. He was a U.S. Deputy Marshal. His wife was a U.S. Marshal. And he was a freight hauler. And he's done all kinds of things in Alaska. He was a very interesting person. He talked very slowly and deliberately and told you his stories. And it was really fun to listen to them.
He would have been a fun guest on Meet
yes,
a Pioneer.
Yes, he would have been.
Any interesting stories that with the bank's 20 years that you can remember? What about the one about the safe?
Oh, we have a very old safe, and I think it's still on exhibit, to tell you the
truth. It's in the lobby, but
it's in the lobby. It dates back to 1904, and on the first day that we opened, in fact, on our opening day, it was 20 degrees below zero. We opened 237 accounts with a total dollar amount of $130,190. And that safe was the safe we really used as a safe. We put the money in there. And the checks and whatever else we had in the bank that was of value that you lock up every night was put in that very old safe. And I think at one time it couldn't be opened. And they called Larson's, but Larson's came through.
Well, Larson's got it open?
Yes, they got it open for us.
Well, right. I understand it was tough, though. I mean,
it was, yeah.
I've seen some pictures.
A lot of doing.
Of a truck or a crane?
A crane was, yeah, to bring it in there. They had to, and it was so very, very heavy. It's a cannonball safe, I think they call
well,
it.
Well, I saw it in the lobby, and I would have never guessed at first sight that was a safe.
Yeah, it was a safe. It, like I said, it dates back to 1904. So, I mean, in those days, I think they maybe didn't have all the cash that we have around nowadays. And that was just the right size for them. Of course, now we have our own vault and safe and everything, and it's modern.
I've also seen some original pictures of your bank, and it's in the same location,
right.
But you would never recognize it.
No, Sourdough Fuel had its office there, and then they moved to their yard on 11th or 12th, where they're at now, and it was completely remodeled from that because a bank needs to project a certain image. And
you mean it was greasy and, I mean, it looked like a fuel business.
It looked like a fuel business, yes. And we wanted it to look like a bank, and it did. They did a beautiful job. And then we've remodeled at least two more times. I think it's two, maybe three, because we extended on Fourth. There was more parking space, and there was also between the bank and Evelyn's dress shop was a driveway. And so, which no longer exists because we extended that way too. We extended toward Cushman, and we extended toward 4th Avenue. And then we put a second story on it. And of course, when we first opened, it was a little yellow building. But it was a good addition to that particular section of 3rd Avenue. And then, of course, now you all know what it's like. It's brown and it has those beautiful big lamps up there. And we have a second floor, which is rented out to John B. Hall Company, an insurance office.
Uh-huh.
One of these days, we probably need that upper space, too. We are growing.
Oh, well, what about now the, let's see, you opened in 65, and 2 years later was the flood.
Right, about a year and a half, not quite 2 years later was the flood. The flood was in August of 67. The water came, well, you Fairbanksons who are listening, the water came over the desks and the files and paperwork. They were flown to Anchorage to be dried out. By the time they got back, the water was going down gradually. There was a very big cleanup job, but eventually it was done. The carpeting came through fine, and some chairs had to be replaced, and maybe some desks had to be replaced in time, because the water does a lot of damage. But it didn't take very long. We were one of the first places again to be open, and everybody was happy, as we all were in town when businesses started to open up again and things went back to normal after the terrible flood.
Where'd you spend most of your time during the flood? At home? With the bank?
Oh, no. I was in Hamilton Acres, and we kind of had to be evacuated. They took us to the university, and some good friends of ours, Marion and George Simpenin, came and got us because they lived in the country. And so they offered us their home for several days. We stayed with them 8 or 9 days. And Ed and the oldest son, who was at that time 16, they really worked at the house all the time. And then I didn't have to do that much. I just did then the final cleanup. But they worked all the time to get water out. We had a little water pump going, and Ed brought in from Clear a big, like a vacuum to suction up the water inside. And so you suctioned it up, and you just dumped it in the yard, because there was still lots of water in the yard anyway.
Huh. Well, shall we go back to Berlin in our story?
That's fine.
This is a kind of a funny way to do it, but I wanted to for us to get to know you and then go back and tell the story of you. Now, you're a teenager. You're in Berlin. The war is going on. What was your impression? From your point of view, what was happening in this war?
Well, of course, I was a teenager when the war started, a very young teenager. And
wait a minute. I know where. Let's back up just a little bit. Before the war came on, tell us about how the Hitler movement...
All right,
they
came to power in 1933, and in Germany at that time, children changed school. If they went to high school, which was you had to pay tuition for, you changed at the age of 10, and so I went to high school. And on Saturdays, we had national politics. That was from 8 to 12, and all they talked about was Hitler and the party and all the good they'll do for Germany. And we had a movement called the Hitler Youth, and it was divided into four sections for very young boys, very young girls, older girls. And every Saturday, our teacher made those of us to stand up who had not joined the Hitler Youth yet. And I was one of four. Two of them were Jewish girls, and he would just bluntly say, well, they don't want you in there anyway. And then he would look at the other one, and he'd say to her, Mariana, why haven't you joined yet? And she was very flippant. She said, why didn't you ask my mother? And he would ask me, and I was very much in respect of authority at that time, and I would say, I don't know. But I would always go home and cry a little bit, and because I wasn't in. And my aunt, who was my father's sister and very close to him, she finally convinced him to let me join. And basically, the Hitler Youth wasn't much different from what your Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts are. Lots.
We're going to take a break right here. I'll be right back in half a minute.
Alaska is still a land of pioneers, like the Binkley family, who for three generations...
Pioneer. This program gives us all a chance to find out more about the fascinating history of this special place we call Alaska, and we look forward to each week's program. We're looking forward to seeing you again next summer aboard the Riverboat Discovery.
We're back with Ingeborg Wilson. Now, the Hitler Youth at the time was perceived to be nothing more than sort of a scouting organization, our equivalent here?
Basically, really. It was very patriotic, and there's nothing wrong with it. Americans are, so why shouldn't Germans be? They always stressed a healthy mind and a healthy body. So we had calisthenics, we had lots of marches, we did crafts work, we learned a lot of songs. Of course, they were tinged a little bit, but I mean, they were nevertheless German patriotic songs. And, I've heard all kinds of stories about the Hitler Youth after I came over here. Nothing like that ever happened, really, truly. We were just a youth organization. Of course, we were supposed to be just for the Führer. And as when you are a kid, you are. When the war started, I was convinced we would win. Of course, I wanted my country to win. But as it went on, and as I knew so many young fellows who were killed, and my brother not coming back from the war, I had two other cousins who were killed during the war. Well, then then I saw the light, and I realized we weren't going to win. And my father always stomped and cursed and said, this blankety-blank Hitler, how can he take on these big countries? He's an idiot, and it's a wonder my father was never picked up, because he was a very outspoken man, and a few times we trembled.
Well, your father did not want you to be in the Hitler Youth.
No, and he didn't belong to anything, when, in fact, one time a Nazi party, he was up in the ranks a little bit, I don't know what his rank was, but he came to our house, and he... said to my father, he said they wanted to express their sympathy, and my father said, for what? And he said, well, for your son in Russia. And my dad said, well, number one, we think our son is still alive. All we have gotten is that he is missing. And he said, secondly, if it weren't for people like you, my son would never have had to have gone there. He took that man by the collar and throat and threw him down a staircase. The whole neighborhood said, oh, Bifey is going to be picked up tonight. He wasn't. He was lucky. That's all. He was lucky.
Because his opposition certainly could have had him thrown.
Oh, yes.
In camp, or
definitely.
Disappeared one. Well, did you have to really do the greeting?
Oh, yeah. We raised our arm and said, Heil Hitler. Now, my dad never said that once in his life. Never. He said, Guten Tag. I mean, that's it. My mother said, Heil Hitler, and she said, I can still think what I want. But she said, why should I be bothered by them? So if they say Heil Hitler to me, I'll say Heil Hitler too.
What was the interaction of you say your family with Jewish people at the time? Did you get a sense of the segregation of it? Or?
Well, at the beginning, the Jewish people were just the first remembrances I have of it, were that they had to wear the Star of David on their outer clothing. It was a yellow big star, and in the center it said Jude, J-U-D-E, which means Jew. And to me, it felt very awful. I thought if I had to wear that, I would feel like everybody would always look at me. And I felt very sorry that we did something like that. Our food was rationed, and the Jewish people also got a lower ration than the rest of the German people did. And you've probably heard this before, but it's really true. At my age, we didn't really know what was happening there until later on, and when we heard it. And of course, if you ever talked about concentration camps, you only whispered, because you were afraid you'd go there too. It wasn't only the Jews who went into concentration camps. At the end, toward the end of the war, in 1944, there was an assassination attempt on Hitler by his own generals, and they were not Nazi generals, they were plain German soldier generals. All right. The attempt unfortunately failed because the war would have stopped right then. One man I knew who was also not for Hitler, he made the remark to some strangers that when he was asked how he felt about it, he said, "I wish it had succeeded because then the war would have been over." Well, that man went into a concentration camp, and he was a German, and he was not a German Jew. So, and then there was a Kristallnacht in 1938. I remember that. I don't remember the night that it happened, but when German stormtroopers, now that was the real elite, that was Hitler's Nazi people, and they went down the streets, and we have, and even in the big city, we have one little store next to the other, and so we had a lot of Jewish stores, and my mother always shopped there, and she always bartered. It's the only place where she could barter, and she enjoyed every minute of it. So did the Jewish shopkeepers. But we went down there a night or two later, and all the stores were boarded up, and my father just said he had to see it, even if it hurt. And you had a real strange feeling.
Because all the windows had been broken. They destroyed their businesses.
Right. And then eventually, of course, they all had to close. And my mother, in fact, had a Jewish doctor. We had a Jewish seamstress. And then you couldn't go to them anymore, you know.
We'll be back in just a moment.
Today's Alaskans are demanding more. More style, more options, more flexibility, and more for their money. And they're finally getting it from Sophie's Station, Fairbanks' newest, most attractive contemporary living complex. Sophie's Station is a prestigious addition to our community, designed for optimum quality, comfort, and convenience. For adult living at its best, see the new one- and two-bedroom units, now available at Sophie's Station.
We're back with Ingeborg Wilson on Meet a Pioneer. Well, later on, of course, the United States gets into the war, and at some point during the war, Berlin was just suffered terribly under bombing. Now, you lived there then.
Yes.
What was that like to have your home bombed?
Well, as I said, the newer buildings had air raid shelters in them, and one time during a bombing, a firebomb hit our apartment, and I went upstairs.
Now, wait a minute. You were downstairs in your...
I was downstairs in the air raid shelter with my mother and other neighbors.
Uh-huh.
My dad was at work. And so while the bombing was still going on, I went upstairs with an axe and a bucket of water, as many buckets as I could carry, back and forth, and trying to extinguish it. It was just smoldering under the wooden floor. And my mother called and said, "Come down here, come down here. The planes are still overhead." And I said, "You want the house to burn down?" And she said, "No, but I don't want you to be hurt either." And so then a couple of men finally came and helped me and dug out the bomb and just threw it out through the window, which no longer had any glass because the bombs also shattered the glass, of course. At first, the glass was always replaced, but in the last year of the war, there wasn't any more glass available. So we were all boarded up, too. And then we often had parts of airplanes in the yard. I mean, little parts. But anyway, our FLAK, F-L-A-K, that's Flugzeugabwehrkanone, they were, of course, shooting and sometimes hit a little bit. And so sometimes something came down in our own yard.
Do you still think about that? Does it ever come back to you?
Not that much. Of course, this is 85, the war ended in 45, 40 years ago. But at first, even when I came over to the United States, I would dream about it a lot. And in my dreams, not only the bombs came down, the whole plane came down. Also, the Russians came in. They were the ones who occupied us first, also all of Berlin. And I was always... I was dreaming a long time that there was always a Russian after me, and I would just really start to breathe real heavy and fast, and my husband would shake me and said, "That's one of your bad dreams, huh?" And it was. And I was almost shot one time by a Russian going down a street. He wanted me to get off the sidewalk for him. And when you're young, you have a lot of pride, you know, and you think, well, so I lost the war, but I'm not going to get off the sidewalk for anybody, and I didn't. And he pulled out his gun and his revolver. And there was another Russian with him, and he talked very fast and kept him from shooting me. So I wouldn't be here today if it hadn't been for the second Russian there.
Well, you are here today. You're a pioneer of Alaska. Been here in Alaska since 1953. You're a fascinating and lovely woman, Inga, and certainly part of the heart and personality of Fairbanks. Just a wonderful time spending this last hour with you. Appreciate it very much. Ingeborg Wilson.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm just glad to be here, both up here in the KFR studio as well as in Alaska. It certainly grows on you, and when you're here as long as I've been, it's sometimes I think the winters are too bad and I'd like to leave, but I don't know. We'll have to take one day at a time. Thank you.
Listening to Meet a Pioneer. A taped version of this interview will become a part of the permanent oral history collection of the Alaska and Polar Regions Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This program was produced by Gail Malloy.
National Court of Justice. We have consistently taken the position that this case brought by Nicaragua is a misuse of the court for political and propaganda purposes.
This case involves Nicaragua's charges that the United States is supporting a guerrilla war aimed clearly at toppling the Nicaraguan government. Romberg insists that the U.S. is not backing off support for the court in general, but
the United States has been one of the foremost supporters of the International Court of Justice and will remain so where the court acts within its competence. We profoundly hope the court does not go the way of other international organizations that have become politicized against the interests of the Western democracies.
The U.S. has always rejected world court jurisdiction in this matter and says Central American security must be resolved only by political and diplomatic means. Nicaragua claims the United States is trying to settle it by military means. I'll have more after this.
You can help your hamburger, you can make it a delight.
Just smile and say cheeseburger macaroni tonight.
Say cheese. Helped her hamburger. Hamburger Helper. Helped her hamburger. Helper. Make a great meal.
Hamburger Helper Cheeseburger Macaroni turns your plain hamburger into a savory, tangy cheddar cheese and macaroni supper your family will smile about.
Hamburger Helper. Helped her hamburger. Helper.
Say cheese.
Make a great meal.
Now from Post Cereal, our traffic guy in the sky.
Can't believe it, Bob. Cars are swarming into every supermarket in sight.
No wonder. I just announced the Post Cereal Money Tree offer.
A money tree at the supermarket?
On specially marked boxes of Post Cereal, you can save up to $6 on grape nuts, alphabets, fruit, fiber, and more.
Wow!
Plus coupons in the mail and local papers with a chance to win a year's worth of free groceries.
Post Money Tree, here I come.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Offer ends August 31st, 1985.
Budget Director Stockman has yet another reading on the federal budget deficit. Stockman has again revised his estimate upward. He says the new projection for a fiscal 1986 deficit is as high as $230 billion. That's about $5 billion more than his most recent estimate. Stockman is quoted as telling GOP leaders that in order for the White House to come in with its target $50 billion cut in the deficit, it will indeed mean the elimination of some programs and not just a spending freeze. A federal appeals court today upheld the verdict against Rita Lavelle, found guilty of perjury and obstruction of justice. In connection with her old job as head of the EPA's Superfund cleanup program, Lavelle was convicted about a year ago. Illinois Democratic Senator Alan Dixon is proposing a federal tax amnesty program. Don Harris of information affiliate WGN has the details.
The federal amnesty is patterned on the successful Illinois amnesty, expected to bring in $200 million. Dixon says the federal program would bring in at least $15 billion and perhaps much more with his carrot and stick approach. The carrot is forgiving criminal and civil penalties.
The stick will be that after the six-month tax amnesty period, we will provide for an additional 3,000 IRS revenue agents to collect federal taxes in the country, and we will double all the criminal and civil penalties.
And Dixon says a combination of the amnesty proceeds and a budget freeze would reduce the federal deficit by 25%. Don Harris for ABC News, Chicago.
Tax amnesty programs have been suggested before, and the internal...